11 o'clock here, and Todd in studio, Henry up in Burlington. It's a Thursday, which means it's time for Green Zine, our weekly environmental news magazine, and we're really looking forward to a conversation with Chelsea Scudder Steinauer from Vermont Interfaith Power and Light, and that's coming up pretty soon in the show in the next 8 or 9 minutes. Let's do the underwriters, and then we'll go to a little bit of music based on the weather forecast. Green Zine is brought to you today by Bale. Also, don't forget, Bale supports the Royalton Farmers Market, which has all kinds of great things happening every Sunday during the summer here on the Green in South Royalton from 11 a.m. until 2 p.m. Tom Wells, longtime supporter and visitor to the station. He was in the station a little bit earlier. Daniel Leibowitz, our original treasurer, who I look forward to maybe riding bikes with later in the summer when he visits up from Washington, D.C., the Upper Pass Beer Company, and the Yes We Can Collective. Right now, though, just not to make light of this, there are some serious weather moving through Vermont. Good chance of thunderstorms and lightning, and even some areas are under a tornado watch. So be very careful if you can hunker down here for the next few hours. I think things are going to calm down by late in the afternoon, but there are wind gusts expected to be between 35 and 55 miles per hour. That's enough to cause some serious damage to trees and to other things. So beware of that. Let's go at least to part of this song from the Drive-By Truckers, who I think originally from Alabama, and the song is simply titled Tornadoes. Drive-By Truckers. Hopefully you'll only hear real train listeners out there. Henry, you staying safe up there in Burlington?
Indeed. We just had a little bit of a downpour. You know, it's backed off again. But trees are doing some swaying, but nothing. There's been no tornado seen in my neighborhood.
Good to hear. Let's keep it that way. Yeah, well, we're having, it's been raining off and on here and expected to lessen up by the afternoon. And you know, these little microburst cells and things that come along are pretty unpredictable, but we'll keep monitoring. I haven't brought up the Doppler radar, but let's move on. Actually, I am seeing right now at the bottom of my screen, tornado watch in effect, and I can't really tell, but it just popped up on this local screen. So I think that most parts of Vermont should stay aware of that. So what's been happening in the world of Henry? You've been taking care of the birds up there in Burlington. Have you been down to your place in Tunbridge at all? I know you're going to be on the air hosting the show solo next week, so don't forget that.
Yes, I have that. So today's show is the first of a doubleheader today and next week. We're going to have people in who are, we have Chelsea Scudder in the studio with you today. And she's heads up Vermont's chapter of Interfaith Power and Light. And they are, when it comes to climate, they are doing what I think is kind of groundbreaking work, that they are pulling together people of religious faith across many religious communities, and she will tell us about it, and are getting group action that way, and I think group buy-in, and that's what where I'm looking for. I'm trying to find the where are the levers that really will make fending off climate change happen. And next week we will be visiting with Climate Action Now, the founder of that, which again is a national organization that is getting people to work together, because I think it's going to take a societal change to have people actually start really ramping up what needs to be done to head off the climate disaster that we are tripping so pleasurably into.
Well, I don't know about maybe heedlessly, not pleasurably. Yeah, I'm thinking of that statistic, and as far as groups and getting more action, and I forget, I think it was about 3%, that there's a tipping point where if enough people feel strongly enough about a certain principle or a certain action, and they're out there either protesting or writing letters, and it gets up into that 3 or 4%, it actually starts to have more of a widespread impact among the other 96 or 97%. So building, whether it's through faith-based groups or like this organization that you just mentioned, or Bill McKibben's 350 Vermont, it all starts to hopefully coalesce in some action to at least at a minimum mitigate climate change and a lot of the trouble that's happening with climate around the world, not just here in the United States.
Yeah, I think we've got, I mean, there's a twofold piece. We need to stop putting more greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And that already, what we've done so far, has changed the upper estimates of how warm it's going to get, how fast it's going to get. It's turned that top number down. But that top number probably would eliminate about 90% of the world as being habitable by humans.
There's the gloom and doom. Yep.
It's pretty gloom and doom.
Yeah, that is definitely
gloom and doom. Survival of only the richest.
Yeah, which is more gloom and doom.
And, you know, technologies come along and they fix things, but making it so you have to live in the Martian landscape on planet Earth is just doesn't seem like a good idea.
Yeah, you know, just a quick example of something that I read, and it goes back to the Atlantic Maritime Oscillating Current. That's pretty close, AMOC. The current that basically keeps the climate in the eastern part of the U.S. and over into Iceland and northern Europe, the chances of that really becoming a serious issue, and as you mentioned, maybe on our more recent show, glaciation returning to places like Sweden and Finland and Iceland. I believe it was in Iceland where the government is taking serious action on trying to mitigate and urge other countries, because their climate would change very seriously in less than a century from now if the AMOC turnover were to actually come to place. And there's some predictions that it could be only 30 or 40 years away. So getting on board and trying to make change is really, really important.
It's slowing down now.
Yeah.
It's already it's already messing with our rainfall cycles and where what the monsoon's not coming to the areas that depend on the monsoons to stop desertification.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you're looking at a worldwide map, it's those ocean currents of warmer oceans and the shutdown of those the diminishing of the of those ocean currents are already causing great stress on, you know, Asian countries and and African countries, and you know, we're only seeing an increase of violent storms. We aren't getting the same level of problem that they are.
Yeah. Before we go to Bird Note here shortly, I met our guest today, Chelsea, at a climate film festival that was held over in Rochester. And one of the films was taken in the Philippines, and they were hit by, you know, record-breaking typhoons in a very short period of time. I mean, not like every 15, 20 years, like three typhoons in about 5 or 6 years. So that is certainly one of the really sensitive areas, real disastrous effects there. But let's go to Bird Note, Bird Note. And it looks like, what bird is this I'm looking at? Is that, that's not a pelican.
It's a crane.
That's a crane, okay.
Yeah, it's a crane. And the reason I chose that, I thought it was appropriate to our program today. It's kind of looking at how all of us can get together and or can work together to have both nature and humans thrive.
Okay. Let's go to Bird Note, and then we'll welcome our guests to the airwaves. You're listening to Green Zine here at Free Vermont Radio, and this Bird Note is titled, Why Act on Behalf of Other Species?
This is Bird Note. Today is Endangered Species Day. With so many pressing human needs in the world for food, water, and places to live, why should we act on behalf of the well-being of other animals? For George Archibald, who's been studying and protecting cranes for 40 years, it's a matter of ethics.
If you consider that other forms of life have a right to live as we do, and we're doing something to prevent them from living, it's an unethical thing for us to do within that framework. Of course, people have to live too, and we have to share the resources. But as conservationists at the International Crane Foundation, at least, we look for that elusive win-win. How can the basic needs for humans be met, not the extravagant needs, and how can the basic needs of the birds be met? It's difficult to find those answers, but they can be found, and they have been found. One of our best examples of win-win is in Africa, where they built dams across the Zambezi River, which really screwed up the floodplains where the wattled cranes lived. Through releases of water in the proper amount at the proper time, you can simulate those flooding events. But it takes cooperation between the engineers, the hydrologists, and the politicians. It's taken years of hard work.
Find out more about the work of the International Crane Foundation at our website, birdnote.org.
All right, let's check up on the cranes. Henry, very nice Bird Note, and I think we're ready to welcome Chelsea Scudder Steinauer to the airwaves. She's sitting right only 6 feet away from me on mic 12, and I'm turning it on right now. Good morning, Chelsea.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, real pleasure to meet you at that climate change festival over in Rochester just a couple weeks ago. And you were part of a panel that spoke afterwards and made some great comments, and I made a beeline to get up and meet you and trade, or I think I gave you my card, and then Henry followed up with you. So thanks for making it over here from Rochester.
So glad to, and thank you. I've already been brought to back to my birthplace of Nebraska with the cranes. That's
Home
of the Sandhill Cranes, and this tornado watch is bringing me back to my growing up in Oklahoma. So,
oh wow, you're used to severe weather events then. That that might have been a little more natural rather than brought on by anthropocentric changes to the climate.
Absolutely.
So, Henry, do you want to give a greeting, and then we'll jump into the substance here?
Yes, Chelsea. I'm sorry I'm not in the studio to meet you in person, but Todd has the upper hand in both categories, having already met you. So welcome to Green Gene, and maybe start off by telling us kind of what brought you to this work. How did you land up making it a major part of your activities?
Yeah, thank you. It's always hard to know where to begin that question, but I think part of my origin story in that is that I grew up with a father who's a very devout atheist, but sort of had a, I don't know if you would use this phrase, but his religion was the world of plants. He's a plant ecologist and a prairie botanist, and
wow.
Sort of our whole upbringing was oriented and framed in the world of plants and a very strong conservation upbringing as well through him. And my mother is an artist and a wildlife biologist and has a very sort of personal spiritual life. And growing up in Oklahoma, I was pretty much raised in a secular home, but in the very sort of fervent religious landscape of Baptist Christianity, and became curious in a few different ways, particularly after 9/11 and a lot of kind of anti-Muslim sentiment that was going on, about the ways that religion inspires people to act very strongly, whether for better or worse, and ended up studying comparative religion in college and graduate school, and coming out of that with an interest in bringing sort of my ecological upbringing back into what I was interested in doing in terms of interfaith work and continuing to be in that religious landscape. And so since then, my work has tried to be at this intersection of spirituality and ecology, and thinking about how religion can be a very powerful way for us to heal our relationship to the earth, and to do that in community, and to do that with sort of a shared, very strong shared moral framework.
Mm. Yeah, that's a pretty good description right there. Yeah. So we were talking before we went on the air about you are now the executive director of, let's see, what are the acronym? VILPL. VILPL.
Yeah, VTIPL. That's right.
Right. But you've been involved with the organization for longer than your tenure as executive director. So that when did you move to Vermont? Have you been here for a while or?
Yeah, so my move to Vermont pretty much coincided with my work for VTIPL. We came here in summer of 2024,
mm-hmm.
and over from Portland, Maine. And yeah, we came. We had lived, my husband and I previously lived up in Jeffersonville about 10 years ago now, and had sort of always tried to get back over to Vermont, and are very happily settled now in Rochester with our daughter. And ahead of that move, I was applying for jobs, and VTIPL had a job opening, and I had previously worked for the Massachusetts Interfaith Power and Light as an intern many years ago, and had really liked what the Interfaith Power and Light organizations are up to. So I was excited to start that here.
So I think I read on the website for your organization that, we only have 50 states at the moment. I don't think we're going to add Greenland. Sorry about that. But 40 of them have organizations very much like your own. So this has been going on in the country for a while. And as you said, you interned in another state. So how do you find that sort of merger of spirituality, which has, of course, been here as long as humans have been around, with what's been happening with the changes in climate and sustainability? It seems like it does not have to be a political discourse. This isn't like, well, only liberals are going to support our work, or, only conservatives are going to feel like if it's in the Bible, then maybe we should try to live our lives that way. How do you find that intersection?
Yeah, absolutely. I think A few years ago, I did an interview project where I asked people all across the country to talk about sacred place and their idea of the word sacred and whether they applied that to the natural world, and to share an example of a place that they found to be sacred. And what I came away with through those interviews was that whether or not people were religious, they had a definition of the word sacred. Everyone had a sacred connection to a particular place that was important to them. And I interviewed people who believed in climate change. I interviewed people who absolutely did not believe in climate change, but who could still absolutely talk about why place mattered to them and why it was important to them to take care of those places. And so I think there is a way that those deepest parts of ourselves, those deepest impulses, our sense of sacredness, however we want to describe that, and which is, of course, very well and well described in many religious traditions, does sort of give us an entry point into taking care of our planet, whether or not from sort of wherever we are on that spectrum. And it doesn't, as you said, it does not have to be political at all. And I think part of what was so powerful about that film festival we met at, and even that film from the Philippines has also stayed with me, is that, you know, that climate change story was told through a shadow puppet show from the perspective of a young girl who had lived through that those disasters, and telling that story in that way was so much more powerful in a sort of heart sense than reading about the statistics of worsening weather, or which, you know, we need that science, but we also need the story and that heart way of connecting to those issues. And and religion and spirituality are also very good at story and myth and making those powerful, potent sort of spaces for transformation.
Yeah, well said. Henry?
Yeah. Are you finding that there is more and more, art, I guess, you know, that was your description was of film art, but I'm talking about art and even humor seems to resonate with people in a deeper way than science ever seems to be able to. And I'm wondering whether you're seeing more and more of that, and how important you think that is in taking real action and learning to find a place to do something and make things better.
Yeah, I absolutely think there is more and more of it. It's been interesting, even just from the perspective of Interfaith Power and Light, hearing some of our board members who have been with the organization for the 20 plus years it's been in existence, talking about how in the beginning of this work, so much of it was about convincing people that climate change was real and that it was happening. And, you know, several decades later, it's more about, okay, so how do we now, most people, especially in Vermont and New England, accept that climate change is here and happening, but now how do we engage people and how do we do that in a way that is motivating and is not so much doom and gloom that we just want to shut down and pretend otherwise. And I think art and story have really emerged as a way to do a lot of that work. And my other hat is as a writer, and so just in the sort of literary space, I think there's so much incredible work coming out, both fiction and nonfiction, and, you know, the cli-fi climate fiction genre, that are really grappling with both the current and coming transformations and what that's going to mean, but doing that in a way that centers story, centers characters, and that I think that really makes it possible for us to access things like grief rather than despair, or kind of awaken our own deep care for places that we care about and help us believe that it matters when we work to protect them. And yeah, so I think, both artistically and in literary spaces and in music, I think there's so much going on right now that is, Yeah, that is taking that on in really powerful ways.
Yeah, and there's so many intersections, and I'm just going to jump in here real quick. This wasn't on my mind until you started mentioning climate fiction. The Vermont Humanities Council sponsored a book called The Light Pirate, which was presented in a lot of libraries around the state, including the Chelsea Library, just about 9 miles up Route 110 from here. And I had not read the book, but I had interviewed the guy that was facilitating, another writer from northern Vermont who now lives in Chelsea. And that was a gathering of mostly people from that town, probably 20 people in the room. I didn't really know that many of them. I don't know what their religious background or their political background or anything else, but it was a very safe space to talk about something that everybody had done. They had read the book, and you know, that has some pretty dire scenes in it. Maybe you've read The Light Pirate. No,
it's not. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I have an extra copy, but it's not with me right now. I'm gonna get to that on the train, I think. But that sort of discussion, which was not only just about the book, but also about what's happening in our, you know, our personal lives or in our communities' lives, and how characters in the book addressed severe climate change in different ways. Some were in denial. Some were taking extreme measures to try to deal with it. Some were moving away to somewhere, I think it was taking place in Florida, that was getting completely flooded. But that type of discourse, like you say, through art or through writing or through music, and we do play a lot of music here on the radio, I think it's really important to growing that group in a sense of, community, safety, and also working towards some positive results. And they can be very small. And I know your organization is involved with people of faith in various church communities, and we should talk about that a little bit. But before going there, I gave my little talk about The Light Pirate. Henry, do you have another comment or question before we maybe talk about what?
I think it'd be great for Chelsea to talk about some of the things that she's seen come out of the work of Interfaith Power and Light.
Yeah, yeah.
Great. Yeah. So I've so loved my time here. And I think for me, the biggest thing has just been seeing communities come together. And I just have a chance to share with each other how much they care about this issue. And I think when that is done in community, it sort of automatically takes that first step to empowering and inspiring people to keep going. And so, yeah, so our work at Vermont Interfaith Power and Light is to really to do just that, is to motivate and mobilize communities of faith in Vermont to act and advocate and care for a sacred earth. And we do that in a few ways. We have a sort of very practical side of our work, which are matching grants to faith communities who want to lower the carbon footprint of their houses of worship. So we help with installing heat pumps and solar panels and EV chargers and LED lighting and all kinds of things like that. We do some advocacy at the State House. So we have an annual day called Faith Climate Action Day, where we bring faith communities together to just speak to our representatives and share sort of a strong moral voice together about why it's important to keep moving forward with environmental policy. We work with green teams, which are groups of people inside congregations that are sort of trying to keep bringing their faith community deeper into caring for the earth in all kinds of different ways. And then we do some eco-spiritual programs. So we do forest bathing, and we have a watershed stewardship program, and we're working on a new Green Team Fellowship program that will roll out this fall. So, yeah, we kind of try to come at the issue from a lot of different angles and give people a lot of opportunities to sort of bring their community into this work.
You know, I think you mentioned the forest bathing off mic, and I'm glad you brought it up again. Having people get together in the natural environment seems like a really great way for not only learning, but empathizing with nature, bonding with your community members. Tell us a little bit more about this watershed program that you're working
on. Yes. So two of our board members, Richard Boots and the Reverend Nancy Wright, a few years ago came together to put together this sacred waters manual, and which comes with some just hands-on activities and prayers and liturgies for faith communities who want to learn how to take care of their watershed. And so, yeah, it's incredible. Yeah, it's all grounded in this idea of holy water, and of course that water is life, and water is essential wherever you live. And it has both we have a Christian version and an interfaith version to, yeah, help a faith community who's interested to learn about their local watershed. There are things in there like actually figuring out how to test your water, how to there was an event when these manuals came out of bringing people out into Lake Champlain on canoes, and and that to me is just a beautiful example of saying, you know, how can we actively care about this this land we're on, both from the spiritual perspective and in a very practical way, and in a community setting that kind of brings all of those pieces together.
So let me interject a levers of change that trying to get this emotion change, this change where we start honoring our relationship with the earth instead of just thinking about, you know, whether we're comfortable in our homes or not, kind of thing. Putting it on a more societal level or overreaching level. And I just listened last night to the latest version of David Roberts' podcast on vaults, and he was interviewing the energy minister from the UK, and they have very ambitious goals to get to the country to net zero by 2050. And there was a lot of political movement springing up that wants to disregard all that and go away from it. So they're having that discussion, and she brought up that her mother had been short on fuel for heating her house when the oil embargo that the Arabs had to try to manipulate the oil market and get higher prices for oil came along and made oil intermittent and scarce. And her mother said, "That's it. I'm never going to heat with oil again. Don't care if it costs four times as much to do it some other way. It's what's going to be."
Yeah, and you're referring to the embargo 50 years ago, right, Henry? In the 70s. That's what I thought. This has got a lot of history too.
Generational discussion.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, you know, and I just, that's a switch. That woman, that mother, just decided that it was time to fix things, not to be trapped in, that was very important to her. And I wonder if you see that happening with your faith community people when they get a chance to have a reverence for the environment when they're working together.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's so interesting, isn't it, that, you know, there are times like with our climate action grants when a faith community undertakes a project because it's cheaper and more reliable, and they may not even have an active green team or a particular environmental focus in their congregation, but it makes just practical sense to switch to renewable energies. And that also then sort of opens a door for us to say, well, and here's why, you know, this work is important, and here's why you doing this as a faith community is important, and here are some next steps you could take to keep this work going. And yeah, I think I was just thinking as you were speaking to that we also have a book club, and we just recently read Bill McKibben's Here Comes the Sun, and which is, you know, of course, just a wonderful, and as Bill McKibben does, a very persuasive argument for taking, sort of seizing this moment to switch to solar. And he addresses this question in there of, you know, shouldn't we be working towards this social and societal shift? And his argument is basically, you know, essentially we're in the emergency room right now. And yes, we need that shift, and we need to be taking these just very practical steps to make it so that our planet actually has time for us to make those societal shifts in time to live on a healthy planet. And I think in this work, it's wonderful. Like we did this forest bathing event last fall, where we brought people into the woods. Our board member, Reverend Nancy Wright, is a trained forest therapist, and it was incredible what it did to just spend 20 minutes quietly in the forest and with some very simple sensory invitations, and then to come together into a dialogue and conversation, and sort of just what it opened up in people. And some of the people who attended had never heard of forest bathing, had never done forest bathing, were curious about sort of deepening environmental work, but maybe not actively doing that. And just right away, it felt like there was just this shared sense of just how precious and important and interconnected we are with our living world. I think that's such a hopeful thing for me, because in so many ways, it actually feels very simple to open up that connection for people. And when it happens, it can be very powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm thinking of an example. You mentioned growing up in Nebraska and in Oklahoma, which I'm not going to ask how old you are, but certainly have a history of being, you know, pretty conservative states, not going to make a whole lot of changes really fast. But I'm going to shift up to Utah. And speaking of faith, of course, the dominant faith in the state of Utah is the Church of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons. And Utah was the first legislature to adopt what we call balcony solar, overwhelmingly in their state legislature. So to go back to your point that sometimes, you know, just, you know, making sense, you don't have to get into, you know, is this a bunch of sort of free thinking liberals that are putting this agenda over, or, well, you know, it's not polluting the air as much. We do have plenty of sun in our state, and my power bill is going down. That is something that everybody is probably pretty interesting in getting behind. I thought that was when we've talked about balcony solar, and it looks like our governor, if he has not signed that bill, is about to sign the bill for Vermont to have that. And we'll probably be talking about that more on a future show. Can you give some concrete? Go ahead, Henry.
So let me just skip in on balcony solar. So at the very, very end of the show 2 weeks ago, I was starting to talk about another Volts podcast where an energy guru who studies changes in energy usage around the world said that he thought that the balcony solar, because it had absolutely, it was something you could just do yourself on the spur of the moment without going through any regulatory process, that it would have a profound effect on adaptation of solar. That the balcony solar units are only going to trim $15, $20, $30 a month off your power bill. They're not going to replace it. But it's an opening of the floodgates. And he thought that it would have a profound effect. We ran into the next program material before I finished that sentence. So the listeners haven't heard that, but I think that's in the notes from from, I think, 2 weeks ago.
Ah, very good. Hey, before I forget, Henry, we have some found solar panels, and we just got the power bill for our transmitter for this radio station up the hill. And it was pretty high, and the Tesla Powerwalls are going in next week to give us backup power. I'm going to have you on the solar team as we try to bring battery balcony solar to the radio station up there to cut back on what seems like a pretty high power bill. So we'll see how that goes.
Absolutely. Yeah. I look forward to it. Maybe I can find more brand new panels for not much money if you
Okay. Yeah, you're deputized.
Okay.
So before we went on the air, Chelsea, you were talking about a project that was going on, and I don't know if you I forget where it was, but it was an example of somebody a faith group that did get a grant. And can you talk a little bit specifically about that project?
Yeah, of course. So just as an overview, our Climate Action Grants program offers grants, a wide range of grants to any faith community that is trying to improve their energy efficiency. And I'll give a couple examples. One is Ascension Lutheran Church up in South Burlington. They last year got a grant to put in some EV chargers in their church parking lot, and those are up and running now. They've also worked with us on heat pumps, and they just got another grant to replace some or put in some new energy efficient windows in a renovation project they're doing. We worked recently with the Fox Memorial Chapel in Gilman, Vermont, which is a non-denominational chapel that is honoring the life of Reverend George Fox, which is, if you go to their website, it's actually a really cool story of sort of one of his descendants coming in to restore and take care of this building. And yeah, we have another event coming up this fall with St. Michael's Episcopal Church in Brattleboro. They have a big project going on called Building Hope for the Earth, where they've gotten a few of our grants to improve some of their building features, and they're hosting us there along with any other faith community or non-faith community that wants to join to sort of learn about how they're sort of bringing their Episcopal faith to this work of earth care. And we give coming up on a dozen grants a year, and we accept those grants on a rolling basis, and we're always really excited about the projects people bring to us.
Well, you just said a name that brought back a memory. And I was going to even ask you about, we have a lot of faiths represented here in Vermont, and then a lot of, churches that are, like you say, non-denominational. I seem to recall the name George Fox from the Quaker faith. I think he might have been a friend back, as they say, in that faith. And of course, having been involved in meetings long before I came to Vermont, the environment is very important to that faith. So that's great. You just said you're up to maybe 10 or 12 different grants a month, but you mentioned South Burlington and then all the way down to, I think you said, Brattleboro. That's really spanning the state. Are the folks that are on your executive committee or whatever the governing body, are they from lots of different places in the state?
Yeah, so we have representation from Burlington and Bristol, and I'm in Rochester, and one board member who had a long stint in Vermont and is now in Connecticut but continues working with us. Mm. And yeah, so we sort of span the state. We've got a few different Christian denominations represented, and I myself am Jewish, and we're trying to bring in as many perspectives and places in Vermont as we can, as we do this work.
Well, it sounds like work that's going to continue, and I'm going to talk to some local groups around here about this rolling basis of the grant. So you'll be hearing from somebody from one of these towns around here.
Good.
Henry?
So I have a question. So a lot of this work you've been talking about has been on making the church property, which is a community space, getting it right, getting your efficiency of the building better, and adding some solar in some cases. And I'm wondering whether you're seeing any rollover effect that is then having other people take action on doing that, either in their own buildings, their own houses, or in other community buildings. Are you any sense of whether that's contagious?
Yeah, it's such a great question. I think, a couple things. I think there are a few communities in Vermont right now that are starting to explore some sort of geothermal work and doing that in a in a way that would be community-wide, and thinking about how faith communities can be part of that as a sort of broader community effort. A lot of the other IPL affiliates, and we're starting to explore this a little bit, have what they call resilience hubs, which are especially in places like Arizona, where it's so brutally hot in the summer, having faith community buildings be community spaces where people can go to cool down or to get, of course, food pantries. Of course, many Vermont faith communities do that too. But sort of finding ways that by improving the energy efficiency of church buildings, they also become assets to their communities in new ways. And even just practically speaking, you know, so many Vermont towns have these beautiful old churches that are in the center of town, and are whether or not you attend that church, it's sort of a fixture and a historical landmark. And so even just helping keep those spaces open and keeping them modern and keeping them up to date through some of these grants, I think can also just help keep those buildings to be assets in their community. So we're starting to think a little more holistically in that way and figure out how we can keep these, not only these buildings, but these communities, reaching into their wider community as well.
What is your funding source? You're giving out grants.
Yeah, that's a big question. and planning to continue this for a while, yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, we're really grateful. We've had just several generous donors over the years have made these climate action grant funds possible for us. So those are, sort of invested funds that are not part of our operating budget, but are there as resources thanks to these donors. And then our operating funds just come from generous donations from our faith communities and just people across the state who donate to us and make it possible for us to keep going.
And you said, I think most of these grants, if not all of them, are matching grants. So the entity that's applying needs to be enough behind it to say, okay, you know, we're hoping to do this $10,000 project or whatever, and we need to raise the $5,000 so that we can leverage the other $5,000.
Exactly. Which is also, that's also so nice to see people bringing their community then into this fundraising effort to be able to provide that other half of the grant that we then match. And and it just gets people kind of involved in a hands-on way, and it often prompts a lot of interesting discussion where people say, well, why is our church going to do this, which is maybe slightly more expensive than the slightly less environmentally friendly option? And then there's sort of a chance to come in and say, here's why we're doing this, and here's why you can get behind it.
So, Henry, we've got about 10 minutes left in the show. I'm going to give you another chance for a final question or comment, and then I have a closing that's related to Chelsea's work, but a little bit of a spin on it before we let you go. Henry?
Well, I always popping big questions in at the very end or big thoughts in at the very end.
That's all right. We got time.
Which is not good logistics. But I'm very interested personally. Have long been interested in soil and its ability to store carbon and to prevent runoff. And I'm wondering whether you've whether some of your water programs have looked at actually the value of doing something to the land to both absorb carbon and to prevent such help with the extreme runoff problem when we get big storms.
Yeah, what a great question. So we haven't, as far as I know, in our history, but I'll now follow up with our board members about this to ask, but I don't think we've done any direct soil work. One of the things our climate action program offers that we're going to be promoting a little bit more this summer is also anything that pulls carbon out of the atmosphere, not just out of a building. So we also fund things like pollinator gardens and tree planting and, you know, little sort of community food or garden projects. And so we're hoping people will take us up on that as a way to say, yeah, it's not just about the building itself, but it's also about, about the soil and also about being reminded that we share this land with other beings, and it's important to build that habitat and to keep doing this work outside of outside the walls of our buildings too.
Right.
All right. My final comment, which includes an invitation to either call or come back, and this was totally separate. Just a couple of days ago, I interviewed somebody that you know, I think, Carlene Kacharczyk.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And we had a really nice conversation about her her poetry, and she did win the Vermont Book Award for poetry. And she said, you know, I have a couple of people that I know that I would like to recommend to be on your literary show. I'll read you what she said in an email that she sent to me yesterday. Well, Chelsea, she said, her first book came out last year, Mother, Creature, Kin. Had a piece published from that book in The Atlantic, pretty well-known national magazine. Wonderful person and writer. Met her while doing a reading with her last summer as part of the Meeting House reading series. Her next book will be with Chelsea Green Publishing. We know those folks. Just sent first draft in. And then she finishes by saying that, as you mentioned, well, you didn't say this, but you are a graduate of the Harvard Divinity School. So, my query is, do you think that I could have you in the future on our literary writer-based show and talk about your book? She's nodding. The pressure was on, Henry.
Yes. Oh, I think Carlene is such a wonderful poet and friend.
It was a lot of fun. Actually, if you want to hear our conversation, you can go to our website and just look up on the replay under WordStream. It's been a real pleasure having you in the studio, Chelsea, and meeting you over in Rochester. And glad that you're kind of a neighbor. We get over to Rochester pretty often.
It's a great place, and thank you so much for having me. I so appreciate what you all are doing here. So thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. Henry, say goodbye.
Yes. Bye-bye. And thank you so much. And keep up the good work. And come back and tell us more stories of what works.
That we're putting this in the positive realm. You know, we joked a little earlier about some of the gloom and doom. But overall, I think the perspective of this episode of Green Zine has been very positive. And you certainly brought that with you, Chelsea.
Oh, well, thank you both so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. All right, Henry, we've got about 7 minutes left in the show. I've got a couple of items. Do you have something you want to point out? You mentioned that Volts, but we talked about that, I guess, a little bit. Anything else? Oop, I turned.
Going back to politics.
Okay.
I want to just point out that I just put in the notes. It's actually posted as of 10 seconds ago.
Wow. Multitasking.
I'm multitasking here.
Watch out.
Who is governor is important. Who is in the legislature is important. And, Scott, I think, has been a very good governor, but he has been really a drag on anything that has to do with environmental improvements for the state. He's vetoed almost probably 90% of the legislation that's come out of the legislature. And when we had enough Democrats in the legislature to override his veto, a lot of those changes went through. And he's running again, and he likely to get elected again.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a recording of the of a recent gubernatorial debate from two Democratic women who are running, going to run for office, and the primary is coming up, and one of them will be chosen to run against Scott. And so there's a link there to that debate, and I think people need to look at it and decide if they can get behind either one of those candidates and whether they think they'd actually do a better job than Scott has been doing.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. You know, and the other thing about the upcoming primary, I've been keeping up a little bit, particularly through Vermont Digger, of legislators who are deciding not to run, in other words, incumbents. And it seems like it's rising to a level that I have not noticed before. There's going to be a major changeover in the legislature, and a lot of people are stepping up. There are several competitive races here in Orange and Windsor County, where most of our broadcast is heard in those two counties. And I think that as we come on August 11th or so, around there, in fact, I'm pretty sure it is August 11th, is primary day in Vermont. And being a rural state, you have a chance to meet with your current representative or meet some of the folks that are running to take either an open seat or to change that seat because they're hoping to defeat the incumbent. And we know that overall environmental legislation this past session really was kind of in neutral, and some things were withdrawn, and there are a lot of changes coming. So it's a good chance for grassroots voices to be heard. And I'm glad that you've posted that debate. So were there several questions in that debate about climate change and the environment, sustainability? Henry, apparently you listened to it. So.
That debate was only posted
a couple days ago, I think.
Last night.
Last night, wow.
It was held last night.
Wow, that's
and
fresh.
I didn't go to it.
Okay.
And it wasn't available online.
Yeah.
So I have not yet watched that debate. I have met both of the candidates because they've knocked on my door.
Oh, wow.
So,
well, you are in the biggest city up there, yeah.
Yeah, and so I have. I know they're both actively campaigning, and I personally just the vibes from one of them seemed to be, I thought, was more to my taste than the other, but they both look like good candidates. I don't know whether... I want to watch the debate and I want to make my final judgment or make a more informed judgment as to who I'll vote for by doing that.
Right, right. You know, and a question you could ask, and I meant to ask Chelsea, but we're running out of time here, is a lot of governors, including our governor, Governor Scott, are in New England, are pushing for the reintroduction, of bringing smaller soldier nuclear modules back into the mix. And I think a lot of people who remember the long tenure of Vermont Yankee and the waste, et cetera, should be asking representatives about how they feel, because I think there's going to be a bill that will be pursued on the floor when we get around to January. And I think it's certainly a concern of mine. Another story in Vermont Digger, I won't get too deep into it, and I won't quite say it's a NIMBY story, not in my backyard, but there was just about to be approved by the town select board and by a lot of residents a backup solar battery that would hold 5 megawatts, 5 shipping container side facility to provide a lot of backup power and an emergency. The town would be able to run for a while after that. The company was Light Shift. The fire marshal or the head of the fire chief said, no, this is a safe thing, but they have withdrawn their initial application. There was a follow-up meeting and a lot of people are concerned about it. So right now, that backup battery system in Vergennes is on hold. And this will be a debate that will continue in various places around Vermont as far as mostly this battery storage is coming from solar. So interesting story. I do want to acknowledge our underwriters here. We're into our last 30 seconds. You have been listening to Green Zine here at WFBR-LP in South Royalton. Thanks to the Yes We Can Collective, also to Bale, Tom Wells, Dan Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, and to you, Henry, and to you, Chelsea. Thanks for joining us here on Green Zine today. Yeah. All right, Henry, you got 5 seconds.
Bye-bye, listeners and all. I'll see you next week solo, and we will... We'll take another dive.